I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about competition. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. You've probably heard the latest data on practice being the key to accomplishment, right down to the number of times we must practice something to do it well. Well, the authors of Top Dog, Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman, say there's more to the science of winning and losing, and the key is something called competitive fire. The book is a look at how to cultivate competitive fire to go with practice. Here are some of my favorite lessons from Top Dog. There are two kinds of competitiveness, probably not surprising to you. Healthy, it's called adaptive, and unhealthy, maladaptive. So the healthy competitor at work or at play, quote, is marked by constant striving for excellence, but not desperate concern over rank. Success in competition requires taking risks that are normally held back by fear. When people say that the difference between an elite competitor and an intermediate competitor is all mental, that's accurate. Becoming a better competitor is about controlling your physiological state, which in turn alters your underlying physiology. So most simply put, if you can control your fear, then you can control your biology too. And finally, for the start of this conversation, it is a myth that remaining calm is the answer for everyone in competition. Ashley Merriman is co-author with Poe Bronson of Top Dog, now in paperback. Ashley, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much. I'm so excited to be here.
Me too. So what would you say? Does competition right now in our society have a good reputation or a bad one?
You know, I think it's context specific. My intuition immediately is, oh, it's a bad reputation. No one wants to say, you know, it's about, you know, competition. Ooh. But if you think about it in terms of talking about Michael Phelps or the Olympics, now we go, oh, well, competition's great. You know, I don't think President Obama makes any news if he says the nation needs to be more competitive. Right?
Mm-hmm,
he makes news if he thinks that we probably don't know. And I mean, I can't even imagine him saying that, right? But I think it's when we're talking about personally, you know, I'm competitive, he's competitive, then we start worrying that the question is, does competition bring out, require bad behavior? Do I have to be a killer? Do I have to be cutthroat to be successful in competition?
Right.
And happily, the answer is no.
Yeah.
But I think that is the concern right now, yeah.
That sentence, she's competitive, he's competitive, mm-hmm. We all know that there's something negative implied about that, almost right out of the starting gate.
Right.
And that's a funny thing. I think we're trying to say about that person, not trustworthy,
right.
Really. We'll do anything to win in the most inappropriate places and times.
Right. And that's what you were saying in terms of that adaptive and maladaptive competition. You know, we think of the adaptive competitor as when you are talking about the Olympics, when you are talking about someone who's worked so hard to succeed. You know, it doesn't have to be sports, though. You could say that about someone who's fought to get a grant for a nonprofit or a singer on American Idol. So adaptive competition, there's a couple key elements that we have to understand. First is the adaptive competitor picks and chooses their battle, right? They know this one's really important. And they also respect the opponent. They don't take their win for granted. They understand it can take a really long time to get good at something, and that's okay. They're having this experience that will help them grow in the course of competition. The maladaptive competitor will compete as cutthroat to get a promotion at work as he will to get a parking space at the mall. There's no difference. He just, you know, he's just killer everything. He has to win. And no one really wants to be around that guy, right? You know?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the guy who's throwing the board game across the table because he's losing Scrabble, who wants to be with him, right? Uh-huh. So the maladaptive competitor assumes they're going to win every time. They have to win. They don't respect the opponents. And, in fact, silly things like rules will... If you understood my greatness, you would just give me the trophy to begin with. the fact that there are rules, well, that's the other people's problem because they're stopping me from getting what I should deserve. So that's what we're talking about when we're talking about maladaptive competition.
Yeah.
People who don't respect the others, compete everything at the same level, and always expect to win and never say, hey, this is a learning experience, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, Ashley, and please pass this on to Poe Bronson, too. I like this book. This is very smart, very interesting. I want to get to
Thank you.
You're welcome. I want to get to this part about what you discovered about the Greeks in just a second.
Mm-hmm.
So you come across people who are, you know, as they say, talking smack, and or can be aroused and angry,
mm-hmm.
in order to compete. This is how they get the competitive fire going.
Right.
We see that on athletic fields all the time, on games on television or in person, and people just look like they're losing it. But I've also seen athletes, in particular, use what it looks like fake anger to jazz themselves up.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Or real anger. Or they may find something which seems pretty petty, but lose it over that particular thing. You know, someone is sneezing too loud in the stands. How can you let this happen? And I think, you know, the idea is that anger is a bad thing because anger is about losing control. And sheer rage, yes, that's a problem. And constantly being angry at everything, yeah, that's a problem. But the research actually changed my understanding of what anger really is. And it's a special emotion because most of the time researchers think in terms of positive emotions and negative emotions. And a positive emotion is when I go forward and I approach someone else. It's a very social thing, right? So if I'm happy, I want to give you a hug, right? I'm physically coming to you, wrapping you in my happiness. If a negative emotion, like I'm being scared, I step back, right? I try and make myself small so you can't get to me. And anger sort of confused the researchers because anger is considered a negative emotion, but it's a positive approach. I come forward to tell you how angry I am. And what the researchers started thinking about is that anger is when you perceive an obstacle in your way, but you can do something about it. You can change it. Your destiny is not set. If you see obstacles, especially unfair ones, in your way, but there's nothing you can do, that doesn't lead to anger. That leads to despair.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So if people are feeling uninspired, you know, an athlete, you know, ready for a game or something like that, finding that obstacle and getting angry about it is a way to psychologically and even metabolically fire yourself up. Because now you're saying, I've got to do something to change my situation. You know, anger is the agent of change. Really happy people are cool with it. Right? They're not going to change things. It's angry people who say, no, something's got to be done, and I'm the one to do it.
This is Ashley Merriman, who with Poe Bronson is author of Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing, and it is now out in paperback. That's why we've decided to have another look at this book. So two kinds of competitive, the healthy kind, adaptive, the unhealthy,
right.
Maladaptive. Okay, we get that. Now, in terms of the when it doesn't work out, what I get from people who seem to be edgy in their competitiveness, maybe dangerous,
mm-hmm.
is that they're walking through the world thinking that what other people have somehow shortchanges them.
Mm-hmm.
That there's not enough of anything to go around, whether it's money or fame or power or ranking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, does that square with your research?
I think it does because, as I was saying, you know, the maladaptive competitor, and even beyond that, you know, someone who has a terrible response. And I hesitated. I didn't say response to losing. Everyone probably expected I would say that. But researchers have actually found that the bad loser is also a bad winner.
Mm-hmm.
The bad loser who says, I should have won. I can't believe that. He's, you know, I got tricked. That judge didn't like me. Is also the one who says, yeah, that's me. Of course I won. that's the person who ridicules the other people when they won. So they're bad winners and they're bad losers.
Well, I think to myself watching, we were talking about this in the studio not so long ago, what is going on at sports matches, at games, when you see people winning in a play or the whole game and walking up to the competitor and screaming in that person's face,
mm-hmm.
essentially saying, well, words usually I can't repeat, but, you know, you're, you know, you jerk, I, you know, take that, and or accomplishing a play, and instead of having a sense of team spirit, no other idea except to stand out individually. And, you know, it's just so disappointing to see this. I think
I completely agree. To me, the great competitor is the one who says, I did really well today, I'm proud, I worked hard, and it paid off. And when they lose, they go to the other guy and say, hey, you won, you did better, congratulations, I'll get you next time, but today is your day. And we really need both of those things. And, you know, if you're not talking about a specific, and I don't want to psychoanalyze, you know, football players generally in absentia, but, you know, some of them may be using it as an intimidation tactic. So it's not about celebration, but they're consciously trying to rattle their opponents. And I'm not necessarily saying that's right, but that would be different than the guy who's so narcissistic that he wants to scream about his success on the field as a way of humiliating the other people. Because to me, that's really the key about the maladaptive competitor, is humiliating the people who are working just as hard as you are. And I'm not into that. I don't think you need to humiliate someone who's lost to vindicate your success. You can be happy about your success on your own. And that's the adaptive competitor.
Well, it seems to me that people want to be seen and they want to be noticed, especially very young people who are starting out in a particular profession. And so they could get into power, to control, to all these issues, because they're so afraid they will be overlooked, not seen, not appreciated. Mm-hmm. And so that stuff, that's how the competitive stuff gets played out in a negative way. So
right.
So I've loved this part you found as you two were researching, to say, what is the word or the phrase that would describe healthy competition? And so you end up looking at a word from ancient Greece,
mm-hmm.
where the Olympic Games, as you point out, were for men and for women. The gymnasium was a center of Greek life. It was a place to compete, you write, athletically and about ideas. So it was this kind of all-purpose center. The word is aratos.
Aratos,
pronounced
right.
Like gravitas.
Mm-hmm.
And so to say that someone has aratos is to say that he or she has competitive fire.
Right.
That competition was this outlet for all other virtues, courage, loyalty, trustworthiness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it's interesting because we really wanted a phrase that wasn't so loaded, and where, you know, we did spend the first few minutes talking about, well, you know, the word competition itself, does that mean you're good, is it good or bad to be competitive? So we were looking to see if there were other ways we could think about it differently. And right, the Olympic Games for men, and then they had parallel games for women. They would play dice, they would have debates and poetry and plays, competitions, and all of that. And they came up with this idea of aratos. And whereas we started by a conversation, does competition bring bad behavior? Is that intrinsic in the competitive experience? They actually said that competition teaches moral behavior. And aratos, this moral that came out of competition, was the supreme moral. It was the pinnacle of morality. Because in competition, to be great in competition, you have to show leadership. You have to show character. You have to be brave and fearless. You have to call on everything you've learned and apply that in problem solving and strategy. And that then is the outlet to test yourself on how much you're pushing yourself. And to me, that's then what we all want, right?
So,
I mean, if you watch a blowout basketball game or you go to court and you see someone get humiliated, Well, that wasn't great competition. Nobody enjoyed that. Everybody walked out going, oh. You know, in great competition is when everyone is performing at their very best and showing you what they can all do and pushing themselves past what they thought. So that's what Aritas is.
On the other side of this break, Ashley, I want to ask you about something you said about fearless.
Mm-hmm.
So stay right where you are. We're going to take a short break and then come right back to talk about Top Dog, the science of winning and losing. Stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton. Find what we talk about on the show online anytime at WNPR.org. Search programs on the tab to find the Faith Middleton Show. Okay, and you'll find something about our book, an essay about it. Ashley Merriman, who is my guest, she's co-author with Poe Bronson of Top Dog, now out in paperback. It's the science of winning and losing. In that list of assets or attributes that a competitive person should have, you said the word fearless. What I want to know, actually, is do you mean that exactly, or do you mean, isn't fear a normal part? Isn't that why trying something again and again it requires courage?
Mm-hmm.
That fear is normal, and the idea is to walk through it,
right?
Not to not have it.
You're exactly right. It's not, it's that fear isn't stopping you from doing something.
Okay.
And that, but it's also about interpreting it in a positive way. So at the very beginning, I said I was excited to be here. Right? Someone else might have answered and said, hey, I'm really scared to be here because this is a great show and I really want to do well. So it's about interpreting things that seem like risk as a positive opportunity to challenge yourself rather than a threat that may stop you and cut you down.
So do you think of the, I get that, and do you think then of the healthy kind of competition as something where you pick, it's your judgment about picking and choosing when to turn it on, when to turn it off, when to stoke that fire and when not to?
Right. That's absolutely true. And some of that depends on the degree of skill and mastery you have in a particular context. So someone who's never done anything before, a true beginner, shouldn't be in competition. This is not about always being in competition. That person needs time to develop skill before they think they're being judged, before there are risks. They just want to know what they're doing, whether you're talking about someone on Wall Street or a kid learning soccer, that they need to learn the rules and they need to know they're good at it. The truly elite, the Olympian, there are other people in the pool when they're swimming at the Olympics, but they're there to prove their personal best. And I know Olympians who flip out when they win a race because their goal wasn't to win, it was to beat a world record or their personal best. It's those middle people, the intermediates, who don't really have a grasp yet on are they really good at something, what can they do, they're the ones who competition is more important to, recognition is more important, I've got to be noticed, I've got to get this done, because they're still testing themselves and they're still trying to figure out where they fit.
And that explains the athlete you see who looks stunned, when they win,
mm-hmm.
As if... what happened? I was just swimming my all, and I can't believe that I beat so-and-so. I mean, that's the most refreshing thing.
Coaches talk about, a practice Olympics. Most of us think the idea of going to the Olympics once is mind-blowing. But if you're at the elite level, they talk about a practice Olympics, because the first time we don't expect you to do anything. It's just too big and overwhelming. But you'll learn what it's like to be in this new level of elite. And then you'll do better the next time.
Does the research show that competition, that competitive spirit, is about wiring? You meet some people Or is it environment that somebody taught you early on to behave this way, or you're patterning yourself after somebody, or are people just born through wiring with this very intense competitive instinct?
All of the above. Absolutely. There's research that shows they're genetic predictors of who is going to be more excited in competition, more driven and enjoying high-stress situations, whereas other people are more likely to collapse. There are certainly environmental issues. Even someone who was born with high levels of prenatal testosterone, so the amount of testosterone their brains are exposed to when they're in their mother's womb, they may genetically and physiologically be prone to be competitive, prone to push. But if they're raised in an environment that says, you shouldn't do this, they won't. So researchers in Italy found that, you know, women who, by their physiology, should have been predicted to be entrepreneurs, if they were raised in households that said women are supposed to stay home and not have a career, stayed home and didn't have a career. So it's a combination of all of the factors. It's not just one or the other.
This is dangerous territory, but let's get into gender a little bit, how men and women handle this differently. And mm-hmm. of course, I start my antenna go up when I read things like this. But go ahead. Let's hear it.
Oh, well, I'll tell you the truth. When we first decided to write a book about competition, my co-author Poe said, should we write about gender differences in competition? And I said, absolutely not. No way. Because I didn't want people to, you know, say, well, top dog says this, and that's the reason women aren't, you know, it running the White House and Wall Street, and, you know, that's, and I would have just been mortified. I'm a competitive person, and I didn't believe the research either. Because when we wrote our previous book, Nurture Shock, yeah. we ran into research reporting gender differences all the time. But once you started comparing the gender difference compared to individual differences, who you are compared to your best friend, it didn't matter, right? So I can say women have less upper body strength than men. That's true. Science that would support that.
Right.
But if I say that standing next to Venus and Serena, I'm an idiot, right?
Right.
So once you apply these gender differences to individuals, they seem unimportant. But for me, the reason I had to write this research was Muriel Niederle, a Stanford professor. She asks people, hey, I've got this math thing, and I'll pay you for every problem you get right, or you compete against three other people, and whoever wins the most correct answers, they get all the money. Which do you want to do? 73% of the guys say game on, and only 35% of the women say yes.
To the big
40% difference.
To the give me all the money.
To the competing for all the money.
Uh-huh.
And the researchers had actually previously framed this as, see, women can't compete. Women don't compete. But the research doesn't support that at all. There's no research that says women are less competitive. There's no research that says women are not as good at competing when they are competing. It's all about the decision when to compete. So, you know, there are 181 million adult women in the United States. A few years ago, only 4 decided they wanted to run for governor. That's a big difference. And what the research is explaining is that women are really good at calculating their odds of success. It's not that they're afraid to compete. The women in Niederle's lab asked, do you want to compete against 3 other people? Realize, I might lose. It's better just to be paid for every problem I get right. So women are good at calculating their odds of success. And men are good at ignoring their odds of success.
So how does that connect with what the expectations are around you? So if you're discouraged continuously from pursuing a thing and you feel unwelcome in a certain arena, you're going to tend not to go into that arena.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We write in the book about Alok Kumar's research about Wall Street. And he's found, after doing an analysis of about 2.9 million financial forecasts, that women are 7.3% more accurate at predicting stocks performance next quarter than men, but women's presence on Wall Street has not changed since really the 1980s. Even knowing that they're good, there's a culture where they feel like they can't succeed and that they're outnumbered, and so they figure, well, that's just too hard. I don't know if I want to do that. Maybe I should go run a nonprofit where I know I can be successful and I know I'll be welcomed.
This is Ashley Merriman. She and Poe Brownson have done this book together. It's called Top Dog, now in paperback, The Science of Winning and Losing. We're talking about competition. We want to invite you to join the conversation with us. Go ahead, race to the telephone. Get there ahead of everyone else.
Beat the person first.
203-776-9677. 203-776-WNPR. You write in the book that when people make this remark that the difference between an elite competitor and an intermediate competitor is all mental, that's accurate?
Right. Well, I was talking earlier when we were talking about risks, and do you think of something as a threat or as a challenge, an opportunity to do something? So the research has found that thinking of it in terms of success, the possibility of happening, is absolutely going to change how you perform. So this is different than positive thinking, because in positive thinking, the sort of idea in the zeitgeist is you're never allowed to think of a bad outcome. And we don't want victory to be assured. That's that maladaptive, right? I take it for granted that I'm going to win, which means I'm probably not going to work as hard to actually win, right? But it's about interpreting the excitement and passion and stress in the moment. And experts seem to, rather than going, oh my gosh, I'm scared, go, yeah, I'm excited, I'm ready, I am fired up to do this. Whereas the novice or the younger person may actually be going, oh my gosh, I'm really scared, I don't know if I can do this. And changing the framing can change the result. So Jeremy Jameson, a researcher, had Harvard undergrads who were studying for the GRE, the Graduate Record Exam, and he told them, recent research has found that stress doesn't necessarily mean you're doing badly. It could actually mean improved performance. So if you're feeling aroused during the practice, it doesn't mean you're failing. It could mean you're doing well. And when students got that instruction, they scored 50 points higher on the math section of the GRE in the practice test and 65 points higher in the actual test, because they were interpreting that physical tension as I care about this. Because we only get stressed when we care, right? If a 14 or 15-year-old said, I never get stressed about school, I'm not stressed about my test, and I'm not stressed about the fact that I have to find a date for homecoming, I would be worried, right?
Wow.
I want him to have some emotional engagement in what he's doing.
You know, you just have said something so fascinating in terms of people who are learning a mindfulness meditation. One of the things that you are sitting there doing is trying to watch your thoughts go by and not be judgmental, but to just register what the experience is in your body and all that, as you know. So what can happen for the new meditator is that you get very judgmental. And so if you notice that you're stressed or you're having stressful thoughts, you say, bad stress, bad person, stop doing that, you know, and they try and teach you not to do that. And what you're saying is, stress can be your friend. So that being able to look at stress as not always such a severe threat as you know, to get so agitated about it. It would be very helpful to think about it the way you do.
Well, absolutely. You know, I just for ease, I try and tell people who tell me they're anxious about something, you're not stressed, you're not scared, you're excited. And they kind of look at me like I'm ridiculous, but I do that for a couple reasons. A Harvard Business School study that came out this past fall surveyed a bunch of people, and they said, a friend of yours tells you that they have to give a speech, and they're really scared about it. What's your advice? Well, 1% said, wow, that's really traumatic. You should just cancel the speech. But 90% said, well, you've got to calm down. But then they did lab experiments where they actually changed the instruction, you know, made people give speeches, but told people advice as they went in. And the best advice was not calm down. In fact, calm down makes it worse. Because if you're stressed and someone tells you to calm down, now you have one more thing to be stressed about, don't you? Oh my gosh, I'm stressed. I got to calm down. Oh wait, I'm not calming down. I'm getting more stressed. It's a spiral up. It's a spiral down. So instead, the best instruction was, you're not stressed, you're excited. And this research actually shows that changing the mindset and the anticipation of what's happening to a positive thing actually changes the underlying physiological mechanisms that are actually going to be successful. So researchers at UCSD study elite athletes and Navy SEALs and people prone to panic attacks. And both groups tend to be preternaturally aware of a smallest increase in heart rate. But this Navy SEAL says, my heart rate's going up. I wonder if there's something in the environment that's causing that. Should I do something differently?
Isn't that something?
And the people prone to panic attacks say, my heart rate's going up. I'm going to have a panic attack. And then they do.
Isn't that something? So, Ashley, stay right where you are. Ashley Merriman is our guest, co-author with Poe Bronson of Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. We're asking you, how do you deal with a competitive person? Or if you are that person, how do you channel it in the right way? Do you struggle with that? 203-776-9677. We'll be right back. I'm Faith Middleton. It's great to have you listening. Want to thank our talented team here on the show, our producers Jonathan McNichol and Lori Mack. Also would like to invite you to attend with me and the gang on Thursday, June 19th, the Fuchmoos Martini Competition. That is at in Simsbury, Connecticut at the Riverview. And we're going to give you an address for tickets in just a moment. It is the most amazing thing. Sound you wouldn't believe. Cocktail making at its best. And you vote in the winner. And also great restaurants serving food. You just go station to station and have the greatest time as people do. $65 for a ticket and all to benefit CPTV and WNPR. In fact, CPTV is going to be shooting the event, so it is going to be a whopper of a night, and we'd love to see you there. It's a Thursday night, June 19th, and of course, we think of that as the start of the summer, the hot party of the year. We'd love to see you there. Just go online right now to ctmartini.org. That's ctmartini.org. Hundreds of tickets have already been sold, so it's going to be a big one this year, our fifth annual martini competition. Ashley Merriman is our guest, and Ashley with Poe Bronson has done Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. This is tricky, Ashley, because on the one hand, there's no question about it. You win something, and it's encouraging. And so you want to keep at it. You want to get better. That's such a boost. And on the other hand, we see more and more parents now knowing that, well, you can't blame them, and then saying, and so if I tell my child, here's a trophy for, you know, picking up your cereal spoon, you know, I mean, it's gotten a little crazy. So you get trophies for everything. There are, you know, you are excellent at something. And kids, I mean, this must be so confusing to these kids emotionally, because they know whether they're really good at something compared to their friends. How do we, on the one hand, be encouraging adults with kids, and on the other hand, be realistic about winning in competition?
It's a great question. And, you know, I think actually right now I'm sort of famously anti-participation trophies. And some of that is because you were right. They estimate that trophy sales in the U.S. and Canada is a $3 billion a year industry. $3 billion. And the focus, I think, is always the reason for giving everyone a trophy for everything is because we're worried about the kid who's struggling. And we have no concern about the kid who does well. We have no kid who actually excels. We don't worry about them. We assume this doesn't affect them. And that doesn't necessarily seem to be proven out. There's no proof of that. And anecdotally, I know, like, kids who work hard and get the same trophy as everyone else are pretty angry about this, actually. But those kids who are struggling, the important thing to understand is we don't need a guarantee of success. We just feel like we need a chance. Right? The underdog walking in who knows I'm going to be crushed and humiliated, of course they're not going to work hard. Of course they're going to want to give up. And who would blame them? It's those people who think, I can maybe do this. And that's what we need to focus on. And not promising kids success, pretending even when they make a mistake that they have a success because here's a trophy, not manipulating them, but having them understand, right, the key to adaptive competition. It takes a long time to get good at something. And if this is important to you, then we'll get you extra practice. We'll get you coaches. We'll work, whether it's kicking a ball in the backyard or reading or practicing words for the spelling bee, that we'll do more to help you succeed. And it's that tangible evidence of self-efficacy, this belief, I can do this, that's more important than a piece of plastic. You know, parents tell me, oh, my soccer team doesn't keep score. I'm like, no. Your soccer team doesn't post the score. Ask the kids on the field. They know exactly what the score is. They know who kicked the kickball. They know who missed the pass. And they are, you're right, confused when parents sort of pretend that they did really well. What they want to hear is honest feedback. To me, that's the keys. Are you being honest with the kid? That's fine. We're allowed to make mistakes. We're allowed to fail. It's about how we come back from that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I have certainly seen some, I'm trying to dump on parents here. I think it's the hardest, maybe most important job in all of the world. But, I've certainly seen parents who think honesty is to then dump on their kids and say,
right,
you were terrible in that game. And, you see this poor little thing's shoulders just crestfallen. So this is tricky.
But I don't think it is, because you don't have to be abusive, to be honest. You can say, well, that wasn't your best game. You missed a couple goals, and I know that you've done that in practice, so we need to try again. That wasn't abusive. That wasn't humiliating. The kid probably would be like, yeah, that's what happened. Right? The confusing one is when the kid knows that they've struggled, and you walk up and say, you're wonderful. Because now the kid's saying, I can't trust your opinions to tell me what's going on. So all of the research about praise and rewards and feedback for kids says that the important thing is about being warm and supportive.
Well, if
and
it's
you can do that having something that is a critique, not necessarily critical, but a critique or something that's complimentary.
Why do we have to have a critique, though? Let me just poke at this a little bit or unpack this a little. Like, actually, Merriman, why do we have to have a critique? If we're trying to tell the kids on the one hand, this is a process, and it's the process that matters. It's you over time becoming good at something or enjoying something. What's the point of the critique? Isn't that a way of saying to kids, and, the pressure is coming from me because I expect you to get better. What if maybe that's not the point?
Well, Carol Dweck, a researcher at Stanford, says sometimes the best feedback is not feedback at all. It's, how do you think you did? Open the door for let them think about, this was my best day, or, wow, this really wasn't my best day, I need help. Let them steer the conversation rather than we say that wasn't good enough or that was great for us. Have the kids become aware of their own expectations and what they're thinking, and that may be the best of all.
You know, the coaches, as you know, that I speak to who coach soccer, mm-hmm. say that it is heartbreaking. These are the good coaches, you know. It's heartbreaking to them that the joy of the game has gone out of it for these kids.
Right.
They've got parents racing up and down the sidelines or, you know, relatives who are very focused, scared to death these kids are not going to get into XYZ later in life,
mm-hmm.
you know, or just competitive themselves and living their lives through these kids. And the kids don't enjoy this stuff anymore.
Right. And again, I was saying earlier, not everything needs to be a competition. Mm-hmm. I would rather have no one get a trophy than everyone get a trophy. Because to me, everyone getting a trophy all the time, everyone being getting praise, the, you know, and I'm not saying one participation trophy is going to destroy a child. I don't think that's true. But over time, I think these constant praise and constant you're wonderful, whether whatever form it takes, is actually giving a message, you must always win. You can't participate in anything unless you know you're getting a trophy at the other end. And I want kids just to have fun and run around soccer, not because they think that this is going to be the key into getting to grad school, but yeah. because they like it, because they're getting air and exercise and interacting with humans so that they learn social skills. I think those are just or more important than any actual performance. And that's really important for parents to keep in mind.
In case new people are joining the show, because we know that happens every 15 minutes, I want to come back to something. This is the Greek word you found, aretas, pronounced like gravitas, A-R-E-T-A-S. And it's on our website right now at WNPR.org. Search programs for the Faith Middleton Show, explaining that the ancient Greeks didn't fear that competition bred immoral behavior. They believed that competition taught moral behavior, that it shaped you into a better person. It challenged you to become the best you could be.
Aretas is about attaining excellence and understanding that the benefit of competition isn't the win. The real benefit of competition is improvement, and that happens in the moment, and it happens over time.
So,
if you have a kid in a soccer game who's crying because their team lost or he did badly, say, but did you do better than last time? Are you learning? Are you improving? How are you going to do better the next time? Aretas is about taking all of what you've learned, showing character and leadership and problem solving, and putting that all together in the moment.
So reading that in your book, you had me thinking about the UConn coach, Gino Auriemma.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his players are very savvy in terms of their media training. So when they're on camera, as reporters can tend to do, going for the edge in a question. And so it ends up sounding negative, a lot of it. And
right.
So these kids have been pretty well trained in terms of media. And so they will spin a question to the positive and answer in a much more positive or realistic way. But when you see these women at their best is when you've got a graduating senior who's asked to assess what this experience was like with him as a coach. And that is riveting because they will say, they all say the same thing. I mean, year after year after year, this wasn't about these games. It was about my whole life. I got to see myself pushed in the way he pushes at what I'm like doing my best.
Mm-hmm.
Both mentally and physically. And, you know, that is something that you rarely get to see. And I think, wow, what coaching this must be to have these kids talking this way. It seems real.
I 100% agree. And I think that, you know, when I was saying that, you know, the benefit of competition isn't winning, sure, we all want to win. But it is about that improvement and challenging yourself to see what's possible. You know, at the beginning of Top Dog, we write about how Jason Lezak had this amazing come from behind that led to the American team winning the relay race at the Beijing Olympics. And everybody focuses on that, and we do, and that's right. But 5 of the 8 teams swimming beat the world record. 5. The 5th team did not go home with a world record. They didn't come home with the gold medal, but their expectations of what was possible, what they could achieve personally and within the team, has to have changed. And that's what we're talking about. That's what I think, you know, the girls are saying that Gino was teaching them about. The idea that I'm not just saying this is what I'm capable of and then not pushing myself, not doing anything, but looking at that other things to say it's about resilience and overcoming difficulty and using everything I have, whether it's love and respect for a teammate or an opponent or just working hard and never settling, that is Aretas. That's that greatness of competition that I think we all celebrate and cheer.
Greatness of character. You know it in an athlete or in a great competitor when you see it. It's not that the person is trying to deny, yes, I did well, but also very fully aware of what the teammates, the colleagues have done to help make this happen. I was going to say, before we run out of time, can you say a little bit about how this plays out in the workplace, no matter what the workplace is?
Well, to me, I think that the Aretas equivalent, we call great competitors, is innovator, right? If you think about Steve Jobs or Bill Gates, before we called them innovators, we called them great competitors. But that's what they're doing. They're problem solving. They're using all of their knowledge to come up with new ideas. They're leading others to think about it differently. To me, again, great competition is about bringing other people along the ride, pushing yourself. But the result, the gold medal in business, is that game-changing, look at the phrase, game-changing achievement. That's, to me, Aretas is in innovation.
And is it competition that's at the root of innovation? Is that competitive sense, you know, my company against these other companies that I know or don't know, anyone who might come on my heels? Is that where it comes from, innovation?
Well, it's certainly a lot of competitions catalyze innovation. So if you have a canned good in your pantry, that's because Napoleon wanted to feed the troops, and his food was spoiling. So he had a competition amongst the French people to figure out how to not have his food spoil, and the winner was canned goods. So competition sort of catalyzed the deadlines and the rules for the things we think are important, which then make a lot of people say, "Hey, I could try and do something of that." And you don't have to win. German biotech companies, there were national competitions, and 40% of the companies that lost still were in operation a year later, because the competition then gave them a reference point of, we need to do this. Here's a problem we can solve. So if great Aretas, great innovation is about solving problems, competition helps you identify what those problems are that need fixing.
Mm. What a great time talking with you. And thank you so much for laying out all this research. It's so interesting to read. Thank you for being on the show, too.
Oh, thank you. It was a blast.
As always, this show is about the richness of life. You can find the books, people, great recipes, wine, and cocktails that we feature right now, including mention of this book and essay about it at wnpr.org. Click on Programs. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.